Okay, I'd like to deal with a hard subject tonight. We have related to it in the distant past. Next week we'll talk about Chalek and Mitzvah Hashem, but let's look at the question that comes up in this week's Parsha, which is the difficult, maybe some ways maybe the most difficult of Jewish philosophical subjects, and that's the question of one person's free will affecting another. We've looked at free will from various perspectives, but let's try to take a look at this very difficult problem, try and explain what the difficulty is, and see if we can work through it. Is that okay? Can we do that?
Yeah.
All right. So, let me state the question, and then we'll take a step back and try to work through it. But I must warn you, this is a difficult subject, and some people find it distressing. It's not what one conventionally thinks. I think there's a lot of misinformation about the subject, so let's try to get it as clear as we can. And at the end, if there's time, you can ask questions. If I'm able, I'm happy to answer. If you'd like a reference for this, so I wrote a book recently on free will. It has a section on this. That book's called Will, Freedom, and Destiny, and there's a chapter there called Does My Free Will Affect You? Or How One's Free Will Affects Others. And you can contact me. I'm happy to download you that section. But there you can find all the documentation of the various sources. There are dozens of sources on this subject. And try to lay it out all textually with all the original Torah sources documented. But let me try to give you an overview of the subject and see if we can get it clear. The question is, let me state the question, and then we'll try to take a voyage through the areas that are needed to understand it. The question is, how one person's free will can affect another person. You know that, as we've explained many times and discussed, I think the deepest axiom underlying the nature of the human being is free will. What's unique about us is that we are free, right? There are only two points of freedom. That's God's and ours. Hashem does whatever he wants. He's an original cause. Nothing forces him. He does what he wants because he wants to. And he gives us what's called, we built in what's called Tzelem Elokim. That means we reflect, we're an image of what he is. And what that means is, among many other things, but perhaps most centrally, is that we have free will. We can do things because we want to. Of course we can do things so we're forced as well. Anyone who's married will tell you that, any married man. But the point is that you can also do things occasionally when you are willing to do those things because you want to. Of course, very unscientific, you cannot prove this. Scientific theory is that you only do a thing in response to an input, but the deepest concept we have of the human being is that you have free will. When you use your free will to do something moral or immoral in the world, and that has a consequence on your own spirituality, we understand that. Even practically, you do something dangerous if you get harmed. We don't have a philosophical problem with that. If you did something dangerous and you got hurt, then you're responsible. You shouldn't have been doing something dangerous. The problem is, how can you use your free will to affect someone else? How do I use my free will to do something dangerous to you if you don't deserve the damage? To put it in Torah terms, we refer to this as the clash between Bechira and Hashgacha. Bechira means my free will. Hashgacha means your divine supervision. Hashem is taking care of you and giving you what you need and deserve. That's certainly a spiritual axiom. Things are not happenstance in the world. The world's not Hefka, as we say. The world is run according to the rules, the emanation of Hashem's conduct in the world, and therefore surely we understand that whatever happens to you, you deserve, you need, you deserve, you had it coming. It's appropriate for your spiritual dispensation. So how can I do something to you that's not appropriate for your spiritual dispensation? Did you see the problem? Doubtful. Let's try it like this. Mr. A is walking down the street. He does not deserve to die. If you interviewed God and you asked him, how do you feel about Mr. A? Hashem would say, he's cool. As far as I'm concerned, no problem with him. How long do you give him to live, Hashem? Hashem says, as far as I'm concerned, it's another 25 years. At that point, B turns the corner and tries to kill A. Now we're in trouble. Because if B has free will to kill A, then he could kill him. But how does that make sense? Hashem didn't decide that he's going to die today. It's not fair. He doesn't need it. He doesn't deserve it. And if you say, well, if he doesn't deserve it, B can't kill him, then what happened to B's free will? Hashem is withholding his free will. Do you see the problem? This is a serious dilemma. And this underlies all human interactions. When I do something to you that is harmful, unkind, cruel, dangerous, or for that matter, something good, you give someone a gift. There's no way you can give a person money if you didn't deserve the money spiritually. We understand that at Rosh Hashanah every year is predetermined how much money you're going to earn that year. What you're going to get is appropriate for your spiritual dispensation. Not one penny is going to come your way if it's not right. So you try and give charity, give tzedakah to somebody. Well, if they don't deserve it, how could you give it to them? And if they do deserve it, then they're going to get it anyway. Do you see the problem? It's a very, very serious problem. That is our problem, how one person's... And why we're talking about it, of course, is because in this week's parsha is the classic source. When the brothers tried to harm Joseph, right? They wanted to kill him. They put him into a pit with snakes and scorpions in. This is the incident in Torah that raises this question, a classic source. And I'd like to try to go through that. In order to get to the subject, let me set the stage like this. There are many layers here. There's not a simple matter at all. So follow me through the layers. Here's step one. Many years ago, during the life of the Pisrei Tshuva, one of the great halachic authorities of the last couple of centuries, the following incident occurred. In fact, he writes this, you'd like to look it up, it's in Choshen Mishpat, which is a section of the Code of Jewish Law, Yud Ches 18. He documents this, but I'll give you some of the background. What happened was, there was a certain individual in that generation, a very learned rabbi, very senior rabbinic authority, who was visiting a commercial exposition in a European town, where people came together to buy and sell. And the way they solved financial disputes there was that if people had an argument, they would make a beis din, make a bet din. They would co-opt three people to be judges, as a duly constituted beis din is, Jewish court of law. And then the evidence would be heard and the judges would make a decision. Even the non-Jews there used to subject themselves to the same arbitration. And that's how they did it. On one occasion, when he happened to be present, two Jews had an argument. There was some financial issue and they couldn't resolve the issue, so they made a beis din. They took two Jews present to be judges, and since he was a well-known, respected rabbinic authority, they put him as the third judge. And here's what he records. Listen carefully. He said, I was sitting there on the beis din, together with these two other judges, and as the evidence began to be led and the case began to be heard, I realized immediately that the other two judges were lying. They were clearly dishonest. They had no intention of judging according to the truth. They were friends of one of the parties. They were clearly on his side. They were clearly going to vote, totally illegally, illicit vote, on behalf of the guilty party. And I would have been carried along with it in that miscarriage of justice. Because in Jewish law, what happens is when a beis din makes a decision, it comes down as unanimous, even if it's two against one. So it comes down, not only that, if the three of us are on a beis din and we're judging his case, and you two outvote me, I'm not allowed to go to him afterwards and to say, you know, I was on your side, but they outvoted me. That's illegal. You're not even allowed to disclose that you were against the vote. And once it's been decided according to the majority, it comes down as if it's unanimous. So he's going to be completely carried along. By the way, that's why in a Jewish court, you always have an odd number of judges. Why a British jury has 12 people, American jury, I've never figured out. That's just a recipe for trouble. But in Judaism, you have always an odd number. It can never be a hung decision. And therefore, two against one, they'll outvote me. And there'll be a terrible miscarriage of justice, and I'll be involved. So he thought to himself, what can I do? So then he thought to himself, well, what I can do is I can say I don't know. Because if you say you don't know and you refuse to judge, the case is closed. They start again, they get three other judges, or they add other people. Because if you say you don't know, that leaves only two, and you can never have an even number of judges in halacha. So if you would say, I don't know, in any of there, that's the response, I don't know, you recuse yourself from the case collapses. He could say, I don't know. But then he thought the problem would be that to say, I don't know, he'd have to lie. Because he did know. So he thought, what am I supposed to do? If I say the truth and I vote for the truth, these two liars will outvote me and falsehood will result. If I say false, I don't know, then truth will result. What does Judaism require from you? Are you supposed to say the truth and have a false result occur? Is that called truth? Or are you supposed to say something that's not quite true and have a false result occur? What's called truth? You know that in Jewish law, in halacha, truth is always contextual. The truth is never the simple meaning of the words. It's always the context. You're sitting at home. The phone rings. Your wife picks it up. From her tone of voice, you realize this is someone you don't want to speak to. So this is what you do. You step out the front door, and you say, I'm not in. And your wife says, I'm sorry, he's out. Is that a lie or the truth in Jewish law?
Lie.
All our authorities who speak about this say that's a worse lie than remaining in the room and saying you're not available. The question is not asking which side of the doorstep your husband's standing on. That's not the meaning of the question. You can't get away with a legalistic technicality. So therefore, it's not the naked meaning of the words, it's the situation. So what should I say? I don't know, because that results in truth. Or should I say the truth, and then the falsehood results, but I said the truth. So he thought of what might be a precedent. And here's the precedent that he thought of. The Gemara says that when the Sanhedrin votes, let's say there's a capital case, right? Which, of course, we cannot adjudicate today. But let's say there's a capital case in Jewish law, then you need a Sanhedrin of much more than three people. You need 23 judges or 71 judges, without going into all the details. And the way the case would go was they'd all sit in a semicircle, right? So they could all see each other. And then they would vote. Now, the voting would go from junior to senior, right? That's how it would vote. And to get a capital conviction, let's say this person's on trial for his life, and you are all members of the Sanhedrin, right? I'm sure you're all duly qualified. I'm sure you're all halachic black belts. I'm sure you'd make it onto the Sanhedrin. The voting goes like this. In a capital matter in Jewish law, a simple majority is not good enough. To get somebody killed by a Beis Din is almost impossible in Judaism. Almost impossible. There are so many extreme requirements that it's virtually impossible. And one of those requirements is that to acquit, you simply need a simple majority. Yes, you've got 23 judges, a majority of one, right? If you have a majority of one, for a conviction, you need more than that. You need more than a simple majority. And there are many, many restrictions on how you can get a capital conviction. One of them is these. Listen carefully. Although you need a majority to get the person convicted of a capital offense in Judaism, there's one particular majority to convict him that in fact acquits. There's one particular proportion of judges who say guilty in the majority against innocent. Although there's a massive majority, that particular proportion to say guilty means that we say he's innocent. We acquit him. What proportion? Unanimous. If they all agree that he's guilty, he's innocent. Does that make sense? Well, one of the reasons for that, this is not our issue tonight, one of the reasons is that if they all agree that he's guilty, first of all Jews agreeing, there's something wrong with that. When a bunch of Jews get together and they all agree, there's definitely, that is not normal, okay? That's a good reason to cancel this case. But a deeper insight is this, that if they all agree and nobody defends him, we are anxious that they didn't examine the case well enough. We want somebody to try to defend him. We want the case to be thoroughly heard. You know, there's an excellent, if you like an educational vision of this, there is a movie about this. You know that? There's a movie. Probably the last kosher movie ever made. It was made in 1953. It's a completely kosher movie. There's not a woman in the whole movie. So very little can go wrong. It's called 12 Angry Men. It's actually in a play. It's an old play. It consists of 12 men in an American jury room where there's a clear case of a young fellow who killed his father. And the evidence was completely clear. And they walk into the jury room and it's clear to 11 of them that there's a conviction. It takes them 2 or 3 minutes. And there's one fellow who has some doubts. And as the play develops, he shows why there might be room for doubt. Right? It's very, very interesting. It's well worth, you get the screenplay, get the script and read it. Very, very interesting. The original movie was made many years ago. And Henry Fonda was the... you guys are too young to... Oh, black and white movie. And it's a very good piece of drama. And it illustrates very well this principle. As Rabbi Avigdor Miller used to say, this is the last DVD you get before you... this is a good reason to have a TV. You know, you show this on your TV. After you watch this movie, you kick out the screen and you use it to keep your Gemaras in. But anyway, be that as it may, if they all agree that he's guilty, then he's innocent. Now, listen to this. Imagine you all members of the Sanhedrin, and we're going to vote. You mind being the junior? I mean, you have to be major. Yeah, you have to be major. So we're going to vote from the junior judge to the senior. You're going to be the all-time black belt champion of the generation, right? Okay. Now, this is what happens. Imagine the voting goes like this. Guilty, guilty, execute death, guilty, guilty, guilty. And all the judges say guilty until the last one. And that judge knows that the person's guilty. Do you see the problem? If the last judge says guilty, which is what he really believes, the person's free. But if the judge says innocent, which is a lie, then he'll be convicted, which is the truth. What should you say if you're the last judge? You're the last judge, you're the senior, you're the senior of the generation, you're sitting there. They've all said guilty, and it's your turn to speak. you know this person's guilty of murder or a capital offense. In Judaism, if he's guilty of murder and he gets off on a technicality like this, he's not freed. You take care of him another way. But other capital offenses, the person's acquitted. Murder's a unique thing. But other capital offenses, the person's freed. So you're sitting there, all the votes are guilty, and it's you to speak. You know that if you say guilty, he'll be freed. And you know that he's guilty. So should you say false to have the truth result? Or should you say true to have a falsehood result? What would you say?
True.
So the Rambam writes clearly that he has to say guilty. Because in Jewish law, a judge has to judge according to what his eyes see. You see he's guilty, he walks free, that's his problem, not mine. You have to say, if that's true, I know what to do. I'm sitting with these two judges, I say the truth. It comes out wrong, that's not my problem. Says the Pesachei Tshuva, wrong. Your case is not like the case of the Sanhedrin. Your case of three judges, that is not the right precedent. You're making an invalid comparison. And I'd like to try to show you why. But in order to understand why these two do not compare to each other, let's take a little trip through our question, our very, very difficult question, of how one person's free will affects another. Are we together? Yes? Can you affect someone else? There would seem to be only two possible positions. And many people think there are two positions, and I would say that very many people think that the correct position is the first, which I'll describe, and I think it's wrong. I think it's wrong. I don't think it's even a valid position, but let me speak it out. People think, well, either you have no free will to affect anyone else, which means that if A is walking down the street and B kills him, the only possible interpretation of that event is that A was going to die anyway. B just chose to be the agent. What we call Habesh Nuchim Lamakom, Hashem has many agencies that can do the job. This person was going to die at exactly 11:35 and 20 seconds. And as he walked down the street at 11:35, Hashem is about to wipe him out with a bus coming around the corner, a brick falling off a building, a rampant virus. He's got lots of agents at his disposal. But B turns the corner with a gun and Hashem says, thank you very much. Step right in. Right? You happen to play into the hands of the situation. And therefore, the murderer is only guilty for having chosen to be the agent that killed. But the person would have died anyway. You give charity to somebody, you help somebody. The only possible interpretation is that we're going to get the money anyway. You chose to be the agent of their good fortune. You get the mitzvah, it's wonderful. But they were going to get it anyway. Which means that you never... Here's the bottom line. You use your free will in the world, and you're accountable for it. And you get the mitzvah and the reward, or you get the punishment. But you never made a difference to anybody else. Do you see that? That means, what are you accountable for pulling the trigger? What are you charged with? An action of murder means the decision and you pull the trigger. But the fact that the bullet found its mark has got nothing to do with you would have died anyway. In exactly the same parallel fashion, his wife would have been affected. All the details and all the spin-offs and consequences would have been exactly the same. All that happened is you chose to be the agent, which means, according to this view, you use your free will, you're fully accountable, make no mistake, nobody holds you unaccountable. Everybody agrees you're accountable, but you never did anything that wouldn't have happened anyway. This is a very reassuring thought. It has certain advantages, this way of approaching things. It means you never get what's not coming to you. Everything that happens to you is totally fair and deserved. But the difficulty with this is, it takes the teeth out of human free will. It means you can never do anything to anybody else that they don't deserve.
I was going to say, could it be that in that situation, person A, whose fate is in B's hands, is being punished for maybe doing something where they risk someone else?
Yes.
For example, driving dangerously.
Yes.
Someone could have just...
Indeed. So in other words, what you're saying is the victim who died deserved to die at that time. Now, the aggressor, the murderer, happened to do the job.
No, they didn't deserve to die. They deserved it to be in someone's hands.
That's a sophisticated approach, and I'll come to that. But that's not the approach I've been speaking out yet. Approach number one is, whatever happens was going to happen anyway. Okay, a terrorist attack, a murder, it was going to happen anyway. And a good thing also was going to happen anyway. Only this person chose to take responsibility for making it happen. So they take accountability, but they never produced a result in the world that wasn't going to happen. Right?
Why is that such a big deal? Then you're still accountable for the free will.
But it means you never affect anything in the world?
But why does that matter?
Well, I'll tell you a few reasons. First of all, that's not the way you actually react to the world. When you go out of here this evening, you get into your car and some careless idiot backs right into you, makes a big dent in your car, and you get out and you say, look what you've done, you're yelling. Well, you wouldn't yell and scream, you're English, you'd say good evening. But, try the Israelis. And you say to the person, look what you've done to my car. And they say, you're a religious Jew, aren't you? You say yes. They say, well, you must believe you had it coming. It's going to happen anyway, right? We don't see the world that way. And it means that although you act in the world and you take responsibility and you get full responsibility, but you never affected anybody else at all. Not for the good either, yeah.
Doesn't it say in the book of Job completely opposite? It says in the book of Job that everything you get, you must have deserved it.
That's exactly what we're saying. Not the opposite.
That if another person chooses to kill you, that's his own punishment, and he'll get that later.
Right.
But you are meant to die.
That's right.
And Hashem only controls the outcome. You have your free will.
That's right.
Hashem controls.
That's
the
what
outcome.
This view says, and I think it's wrong. Job doesn't. I don't think Job disagrees with that. Give me a few minutes to try to build this. The thesis I'm putting forward now, option number one, is that whatever's going to happen is going to happen anyway, and you get only what's coming to you, good or bad. Human free will only is the choice to be the actor in the situation, but it's got nothing to do with the result. First of all, that's not a natural way of looking at the world. The world does not appear to us that way. And secondly, it would mean that you never make a difference to anybody else. 10 o'clock at night, you always make your wife a cup of tea, right? Always, right? Yeah, okay, whenever it is. No matter how tired you are, you've got a headache, this is what you do. You're an act of love. You make a cup of tea. And you think you're a big deal. You know, if you wouldn't have done it, somebody else would have. You know, she's going to get it anyway. She's going to get what's coming to her. You can never help anybody in a way that wasn't going to happen anyway, according to this view. There's another view. The other view is that somebody could affect someone else in a way that was not going to happen anyway. It's possible that when A kills B, B would not have died at that moment. It's possible. What does that mean? On the one hand, that's incredibly powerful for your own free will. You can really make a difference to somebody. It really depends on you. They wouldn't have died. On the other hand, that is very scary. That means you can be in the world vulnerable to another human being in a way that nothing else could affect you. Or this would mean that people are dangerous, in case you hadn't noticed. People are dangerous. I think, and I think it's clear, and with enough time, I think I could demonstrate this. And again, if you look at the sources, I think you'll see clearly, I think there's only one of these two approaches is viable, and it's the second one. I personally don't know of any sources that speak of the first one. Right? I don't know of any. There are one or two that are classically quoted. I'll just mention one of them, only to show that I think it's wrong. Because superficially read, at the part that's quoted usually seems very much to say you only get what you deserve and what's coming to you anyway, like you spoke out. But I think it's wrong. The classic source is this. There are one or two, but the classic one is probably Rav Sadia Gaon. Of Sadjagon in his famous work, Emunas Vadeus, Emunot Vadeot, he says, in a classic language as only the greats of that generation could, speak this shortly and succinctly, he says that when someone's walking down the street, when A kills B, someone murders someone else, all that happens is a Misa becomes a Retzach, a Mita becomes a Retzach. That's incredibly eloquent. That means a death becomes a murder. The death was going to happen anyway. Now it's a murder. But had he not murdered him, he would have died. And the second sentence, he says, when someone suffers a financial loss, if somebody robs, somebody steals from someone else, all that happens is a loss becomes a theft. But the loss would have happened anyway. Had the person not stolen it, it would have fallen down the well, it would have broken, you will not lose that money anyway. So he clearly seems to be saying that when someone dies, the death was inevitable. Only now it becomes a murder. The loss was inevitable. You can't get that, you get what you deserve. Only the person stole it. They become accountable. It's now called a theft. The problem is, if you back up two lines in that paragraph, he very clearly says exactly the opposite. This is what he says. He says, when somebody's walking down the street and there's a din of misa on them, there's a gzera min hashamayim, there's a decree of death on him. In that case, when someone kills him, all that happens is the death is now called a murder. And when someone has a decree in heaven that they'll lose a certain amount of money and someone steals it, in that case, all that happens is the loss becomes a theft. But he says nothing about a situation where there's no decree. And that's the case we're interested in. I'm interested in Mr. A walking down the street where there's no divine decree of death. If there's a divine decree of death, of course he's going to die. No one argues about that. But could you kill someone who does not have a decree hanging over him? That's the question. And on that he says nothing. Okay. There are many Torah sources. I don't have time this evening to share with you all of them. But there are tremendous number of sources that say clearly in Judaism that you can hurt someone, you can do something to somebody else that they do not deserve and would not have happened otherwise. There's severe limitations to this, so just give me a chance to build it, And I'll try to explain. I see some people getting distressed already. So stay tuned. Stay tuned. I warned you. According to this way of thinking, Mr. A is walking down the street, B kills him. There are two possibilities. Either he had a decree and he was going to die anyway. Certainly, that's possible. But it is possible that Hashem would not have killed him. And Hashem allows somebody to kill him because human free will is so important. Hashem is going to say, I created the world for this. You want to kill him? I don't think he deserves to die. But I'm not going to interfere with your free will. Now, let me give you some proofs. But listen objectively to the proofs. I'll give you a brief proof, which is elegant, succinct. I heard this from Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg from Baltimore. But you'll find it written in various sources. You know, when we do Tachanun, we say, Vayomer David el Gad, David said to God, Nipla na beyad Hashem. Let us fall into Hashem's hand. Ki rabim rachamav, because his mercy is very great. Ubayad adam al epola. Let me not fall into human hand. That's very interesting. King David is facing two options. There was a certain time in his life when Hashem said to him, you have sinned and you need to be punished. You need to suffer, you and the Jewish people. But I'm going to give you two options. Do you want to suffer by disease? Do you want an outbreak of disease? Or do you want enemy attack? Which would you like? So David Hashem, Nipnana b'yad Hashem, I want the disease, because that's you. V'yad Adam, let me not fall into human hand, because they're not to be trusted. You, I know, will deal with me kindly. Human beings could be very cruel. So he chose to be dealt with directly by Hashem. That's very telling. Again, if you take the first view, you're only getting what's coming to you. Flip a coin, what difference does it make? What difference does it make? Wild animals, disease, human, Philistine soldier, every sword has your name on. Every bullet has your name on. What's the difference? Flip a coin. David said, Hashem, I'd rather deal with you. Ki rabim rachamav, you can be trusted to be merciful. Humans could be more cruel, which means, obviously, it makes a difference. Again, if you're only going to get what's coming to you, who cares which way it comes? Flip a coin. Is this clear? Just 1 second. When David says, Hashem, I do not want to deal with humans. Humans have free will. They can be more cruel. They can hurt me more than I deserve. But from you, I'll never get more than I deserve. So deal with me directly. This is a very strong indication that it makes a difference whether it's a human acting against you or non-human. Did you see that? Let me share with you the classic source. This week's parsha, we have the classic source. The Zohar speaks this out in exquisite detail. It's a whole page in the Zohar. But the most famous source is the Or HaChaim. He speaks it out, if anything, more explicitly. And let me tell you what he says. This you have to get clear. This is the classic source. If you haven't studied this, you haven't studied the subject. The great Or HaChaim, great Torah commentary, says this. When the brothers decided to kill Joseph, what happened? They saw Joseph approaching, and they said, behold, this dreamer of dreams approaches. Let's kill him. Let's see, yeah, what happens of his dreams. Joseph dreamed that in the future, the family would bow down to him. They felt, the brothers, that was a completely illicit and false dream. He was trying to take power, which was a life and death matter, without going into all the details, and therefore deserved to be killed. How brothers could make a bet in on a brother, there's many questions here, but that's what they decided. So as he approached, they said, let's kill him and see what becomes of his dreams. The meaning of that, says the Rachaim, is that Joseph was 17 years old, and he dreamed, here's Joseph's life, he's born, 17 years old, he dreams that somewhere in the future, the family will bow down to him. They said, look, let's kill him. And then we'll immediately see that his dreams are false. Because if he dies now, we know now that the dreams are false. We don't have to wait. Again, he dreamed that somewhere in the future we'll bow down to him. If we kill him, can we be sure that we're right? Yes. Because the moment he dies, there are no dreams that can be fulfilled in the future where we bow down to him, because he's dead. Therefore, justice will be done and it will be seen to be done. So not only will we kill him and justice will take place, but it will be apparent now that he deserved it. Clean conscience. No. At that moment, the oldest brother, Reuben, said, gentlemen, you're making a serious mistake. I'm telling you that you could kill him even if he does not deserve to die. Sure, he has to be vulnerable. We'll talk about that. But it's possible that he is not guilty of the crime that you think. It's possible that his dreams were true. And you will kill him because Hashem will let you use your free will to kill somebody, even if Hashem did not have a decree on that person to die. Because human free will is so important, he will let it happen. You'll conclude that you were right and you'll be wrong. So the brothers said, what should we do? So Reuben said, don't touch him. Throw him into this pit. Now the pit contains snakes and scorpions. So the question obviously is, don't kill him, throw him into this pit of snakes and scorpions. What are you doing? The Maharal says it was not full of snakes and scorpions, but it had enough in it to be very dangerous. Meaning that You throw a person into a dangerous situation where the danger is not human. That's not human hand. Human hand's not going to touch somebody. That means if it's going to be snakes and scorpions who have no free will, they will only do what the decree, no self-respecting scorpion is going to touch you unless there's a decree because he has no free will. But your human free, your hand, there's no telling. And so they threw him into the pit of, the language in the Orach Chaim is exquisitely beautiful. He says, Vayatzilehu, the Torah says, Vayatzilehu miyadam. He saved him from their hand. He saved him from their hand. Says the Orach Chaim, he did not save him from his fate. He saved him miyad habechiri, from the hand of human free will. He was not interested in saving Joseph from what was coming to him. He was interested in saving him from human free will. Because a human hand with free will could kill a person even if he does not deserve to die. And that's why they chose to make him subject, vulnerable. The Medrash says that when they saw him coming, they set their dogs on him. Because dogs have no free will. They figured that if the dogs kill him, it must be deserved. Yeah.
What about the case, you mentioned Dalai Lama, isn't there a case where someone curses him?
Yes.
Yes. Him, and he says to them,
I'll get to that, yes. Because Hashem told him to curse. That's one of the difficult sources in this discussion. If I don't get to it tonight, read my book. And you'll see a discussion of that. There's a very amazing incident in David's life. But, by the way, that incident is almost impossible to understand no matter what approach you take. God told him to curse. God tells people to do sins. What does that mean? However you cut it, that's a very, very difficult incident. But be that as it may, this classic Zohar is the classic source. The Zohar says it, or Orach Chaim says it. They put him into a situation of serious danger that was not danger at human hand. There's a big discussion in Halacha. If you put a person in a situation of danger, is that considered your action or not? Let's say you hold someone's head underwater and you say, I didn't kill him, it was just a lack of oxygen. That's called murder in Judaism. So it has to be something that's not directly your force. But you put someone in a situation where there's danger, not inevitable death, but danger, that is once removed, and therefore you couldn't be tried. In spiritual terms, you'd be guilty, but you couldn't be tried in a human court for that. So the classic source is this source. It's very difficult to answer, to argue with. All our authorities say the same thing. The Altshuk says this, the Malbim, the Netziv, the Orach Chaim here, they all say exactly the same thing, that the reason they did this was because they were anxious that if they used their hand against him, they could not prove that he was guilty. But if a scorpion killed him, that could only happen if he deserved it. There are many other sources that say this. Let me share with you one or two. I mean, there's so many sources that, you know, on this side, and as I said, I'm not really aware of even one source that speaks the opposite. Once you start to see this, you see it everywhere. One obvious one that comes to the mind is this. You know, the Jewish people in Egypt were tortured by the Egyptians. Right? Tortured by the Egyptians. And one of the questions that the Rambam raises is, why were the Egyptians punished for doing what was predicted to the Jewish people? Here you're not just talking about what was destined and decreed. This was openly predicted. That's a whole new level of problem. God said to Abraham, Hashem says to Avram, they're going to be strangers in a strange land. They're going to suffer for 400 years. They'll be enslaved. The Egyptians do exactly that. And Hashem punishes them. Do me a favor. The Egyptians should have got reward. Hashem, we fulfilled your decree. You announce that the Jewish people are going to suffer. You're going to be enslaved. We enslave them. Reward us. How can you punish the Egyptians for doing what was inevitable, completely inevitable, announced prophetically? You see the problem. There are many answers to this question. But listen to one of them that the Ramban gives. Listen carefully. Ramban says, again, there are other answers, but I'm focusing on this one. He says the reason the Egyptians were punished was not because they enslaved the Jewish people. Indeed, that was decreed. But because they were more cruel than necessary. There were no reason to kill their children and bake their babies into bricks in the walls and all the torture that they did to the Jewish people, that's what they were punished for. Meaning, they were not punished for doing what was decreed. They were only punished for the extra. Now, this is a long discussion, but listen carefully. That means that they could do extra. That means you could do something to somebody that was not decreed. It says it clearly. They were only punished for doing what was not decreed. Means human beings are free to do to somebody, to something that's not decreed. You see it clearly here. And there are many other sources. I'll give you one other one. When Daniel was thrown into the lion's den, you remember the incident? King Darius was the king of Persia, and Daniel was his court advisor. He was a great man in the palace. And of course, there were non-Jewish courtiers who were jealous of him. They hatched a plot to tell the king that Daniel was a traitor and therefore worthy of death. Darius thought very highly of Daniel. He was his advisor. In fact, some of the Persian kings used to worship him. They thought he was a semi-god. So he said like this, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to throw him into a pit of hungry lions. If he's a great spiritual man, as I think he is, he'll survive. The hungry lions won't touch him. His God will protect him. If he's guilty and a traitor, he'll be eaten by the lions. And that's what happened. He threw him into the pit and he survived. But listen carefully. Read the psukim. It says he threw him into the pit of lions and he sealed the entrance of the cave where the lions were. Why? Because he's worried that one of the jealous enemies of Daniel would kill him with a spear or shoot an arrow at him and kill him. And then say the lions, and the lions would tear him to pieces. And then they would say the lions killed him. So to stop these people killing Daniel and then saying the lions had done it, he sealed the entrance to the pit. Means he was worried about human beings killing Daniel. He wasn't worried about hungry lions. Why? Hungry lions got no free will. If Daniel doesn't deserve to die, the lion's not going to... No self-respecting hungry lion is going to touch you if there's no decree on you to die. But there's no trusting a human who's jealous of you. He could kill you even if you don't deserve to die. And Darius knew that. So he protected him from humans because that wouldn't be any test at all. Did you see? It's a very beautiful proof. I think the Netziv brings this. There are many, almost, there are so many sources that make it clear that a person could kill somebody else, harm someone else, help someone else, even when there's no decree. To be sure, let's not get confused. God has to allow it. Hashem can stop it. And if you deserve to be protected, he's going to protect you. And once you put a person in a situation of danger, Hashem is going to make a new decision. Do you deserve to be saved? Maybe yes, maybe not. And many cases could be cases where there is a decree on a person. That's all true. But there remains an area of possibility where a person could do something to somebody else, even when the victim or recipient did not deserve it. At least in that situation, there'll have to be a new decree whether he deserves or doesn't deserve to be protected. Let's put it this way. According to this way of thinking, you could put a person in a situation of danger that raises the question of whether they deserve to be saved, and if they don't, they might die, which would not have happened otherwise. Of course, in the situation, they deserve what they're going to get. They weren't worthy of being saved. That could be. Just one second. Let me try and add a little dimension to this. I'll leave time at the end, if I can, for questions. Are we saying, according to this Or HaChaim, that you can do something, anything you like, to anybody under all circumstances? No. There are serious limitations to how much you can affect someone else. And by the time you've seen all of them, the gap between these two positions is not so great. Let me speak out a few of them. Pay attention, because it's important to understand these. Number one, when we say that a human being can affect someone else in an unfair way, in a way that was not decreed, but only to the extent that the person is spiritually vulnerable. What we say, they lack schus, they lack zechut, they need schus. That means somebody could affect someone else only to the extent that this person, the fear was that Joseph might not be guilty of a death sentence, but maybe he had done something wrong that left him vulnerable to their free will. If you have enough merit, you'll not be vulnerable. To take an extreme example, you have what's called tzaddik gamur. That means a person who's so totally righteous, nobody can touch him. The classic example in Jewish history is Mordechai. He knew that he could not be touched by Haman, and he used that to drive Haman crazy. He sat where Haman would walk past, and his plan was to drive him into such an anti-Semitic frenzy that he would self-destruct. Very dangerous game. The principle in Jewish history in the post-prophetic era is Eretz Nitna B'Yad Rasha. Eretz Nitna B'Yad Rasha. The world is in the hand of the wicked, in case you hadn't noticed. Right? In case you think the world is run by benevolent, you know, leaders who are worried about your welfare. The world is run by vicious, brutal individual who kill you for far less than a vote, unfortunately. And therefore, to confront evil in a full frontal attack on evil is extremely dangerous. The Jewish strategy is to walk between the raindrops, use your head. Right? That's the strategy in this phase of history. And therefore, to stand in front of Haman and drive him crazy when he was the most powerful man in the world, virtually, extremely, but Mordechai knew he could not be touched. And if you're totally spiritually invulnerable, no amount of free will can touch you unless there's a decree on you anyway. The problem is, what if you're not totally, you've done something that makes you vulnerable? And here's the thing. When we say one person's free will can affect another, we mean to the extent that that person is spiritually vulnerable, to the extent that they lack schus. Enough schus, you'll be protected. And it's a trade-off between the power of the free will agency. How powerful is this person using their free will? Right? We're talking about a person who's big enough to do this, not some 14-year-old Arab that they put a bomb on his back and send him to a bus in Jerusalem. We're talking about somebody who's a manifest free, and by the way, it has to be against the individual, not against a group. The Al-Sheikh says that. When one person targets a group and group damage, it's another whole discussion. We're talking about a targeted individual by somebody. These people were the brothers, the 12 tribes of Israel, the great brothers, 10 of them. And they were. They had cosmic power. They have the power to affect somebody, even to a level that he doesn't deserve. So it's an interaction between the power of the freedom of the one who's acting and the vulnerability spiritually of it. And by the way, it doesn't have to be your source. It could be your wife's. Mr. A is walking down the street. B tries to kill him. A does not deserve to be saved. But his wife doesn't deserve to be a widow. Good enough. This is why, by the way, some people don't take out insurance. No, you should take out insurance. It's very important. Take out life insurance. But some people don't. Reason is, Mr. A is walking down the street. He's got no life insurance policy. B tries to kill him. Hashem looks down and says, well, you know, you deserve to die, but your wife, who's going to bring home the bacon? Or whatever you bring home. You know, your wife doesn't deserve this. You're the breadwinner. So he'll protect you because she doesn't deserve it. But if Mr. A is walking down the street and he's got a £100 million life insurance policy and B tries to wipe him out, Hashem's going to look down and say, your wife's okay. Some husbands I know, she's probably better off. This is a good reason to make yourself indispensable to many people. You should single-handedly support so many poor families that when you, Mr. A, walking down the street and someone tries to rub you out, Hashem's going to say, you know what, it's just too complicated. I'm going to put up with you. I'll put up with you in the world because all those people need you. This is not the highest motivation for stocker, but it's kosher. And it's a good way to go. So we're talking about what's your level of protection spiritually. Somebody could affect you only if you're vulnerable, and could be what you said. Then what Hashem does is you're vulnerable enough to be left to the free will of somebody else. The decree is you're vulnerable to his free will. Right? There are many other exceptions also. Groups does not apply. There's a whole discussion about groups. When it's a mass destruction, like a Holocaust, lo aleinu, then there's a principle, kiven shenitin reshus lemashchis la'ashchis, when permission is given to the destroyer to destroy, shuv eno mavchin bein tzadik la'ashchis. It makes no distinction between good and evil. Another amazing concept. That when masses are destroyed, there's no discerning between those who deserve and those who don't. As far as we can see, that's another whole discussion. Wartime is completely different. Milchamos ani asisi. Hashem says, I conduct wars. That's another issue. Another exception is people of major political power. Leiv melech beyad Hashem. Right? The heart of a king. Leiv melachim b'sof. The heart of a king is Hashem's hands. Meaning when a king or a prime minister or a president or a mayor of a major city does something that affects thousands of people, vast numbers of people, they are only getting exactly what they deserve. In Jewish thinking, a person of major political power has no free will at all when it comes to his actions, external actions. In Western society, we think when a man's elected prime minister, then he has real power. In Judaism, at that moment, he became a complete puppet. Just one second. People of major political power, nobody can affect the course of history. That will always be brought back into line. Masses of people you have no authority to affect. And therefore, Leiv Melech Bayad Hashem, the heart of a king is Hashem's hand, where he wants to lean that or push it or incline it, that's the way he chooses, and that's not amenable. So there are many limitations of free will. But in that narrow zone where a person has enough free will and the person is vulnerable, and none of these exceptions apply, there are circumstances where you could put a person in a situation of danger that you would not be otherwise. Before you ask questions, let me try and close the circle, come back to our original starting point. Are we clear? There are two possible positions. One is you never touch anyone else. Whatever you do was decreed already. I think that's wrong. I don't know any Torah sources that support that. Yeah, you could argue, maybe you'll find something. But all the sources I'm familiar with very clearly make it apparent that the opposite is true, that there are circumstances where one person could put another person in a situation that was not decreed, and in that situation will need to be invoked a decree. Do they deserve to be protected? Don't they? There'll be a new discussion, and of course whatever happens will happen by Hashem's permission. Nothing happens against his wishes, that's completely clear. But there is room to move in this narrow zone. Let me give you one more source, and then we'll close the circle. This is a work called the Chinuch. You know, the Chinuch is a work of mitzvahs, a work written 800 years ago, going through all the mitzvahs. One of the great works of Jewish Torah work. Very embarrassingly for us, it was written for a 12-year-old. It's one of the major works we have today in study of the mitzvahs. It was written for a 12-year-old. The author wrote it for his 12-year-old son preparing him for a bar mitzvah. And I think absolute classic on all the mitzvahs. A little embarrassing, but if you care to come down to that 12-year-old level, You should get yourself a copy. It's available in the English translation. You study one mitzvah every Shabbos at the table. Very beautiful. You get through all the mitzvahs. But he's famous for not only giving you the details of the mitzvah, he also gives you the reasons, what he calls Mishor Shea mitzvah. Why would Hashem want this? Why would God want you to send away a mother bird? Why would he want you to give charity? Why would he want you to eat matzah? What's behind the mitzvahs, as far as human beings can say? And there are two places when he touches on our subject and appears to contradict himself. And that's impossible. You're talking about one of the greatest sources of that generation. There's no way you can say two opposite things on the same subject. Let me show you the contradiction and how I think it should be resolved. And this relates to what you raised. The first source is this. In Mitzvah Resh Mem Aleph and Resh Mem Beis, that's 241-242, it talks about the prohibition of taking revenge and bearing a grudge. You know, in Judaism, you're not allowed to take revenge or bear a grudge. Nekama means revenge, doing something to somebody that they did to you. Netira means not doing it, but reminding them, holding the grudge against them, right? You go to your neighbor, can I please borrow your lawnmower? He says no. A week later, he comes over to you, can I please borrow yours? You say no. Forbidden in Judaism. You're doing to him what he did to you, that's taking revenge. Bearing a grudge is you go to your neighbor, say, can I borrow your lawnmower? He says no. Next week, he comes over to you and says, can I borrow yours? You say, sure, I'm not like you. That's bearing a grudge, right? You remind him. They tell the story of a man crawling through the desert, about to die of thirst. Another fellow on horseback looked at him, left him to die. Miraculously, the person survived. And a few years later, he turned out to be the president of a big business corporation. One day, his office door opened and a man came in begging for a job. And he recognized the face of the man who left him to die in the desert. If he would have refused him the job, he'd be guilty of taking revenge. If he gave him the job and reminded him, he'd be guilty of bearing a grudge. He said nothing and gave the man the job. That's what you're required to do as a Jew. Of course, if he's unsuitable for the job, let's say he's applying to be the gentle, tender caregiver of frail little old ladies, and you think he might not be suitable, he's got a streak of, there, that's fine. If your neighbor destroys lawnmowers, you can say no. But if the personal, small-minded childishness, that you're not allowed to do. Now, listen carefully. Says the Chinuch, why would Hashem not want you to take revenge? Why? What lies behind the mitzvah? And he says this. Imagine this person harmed me. There's a very powerful motivation to do to the person. Yeah, it's one of the sweetest feelings when you do back to somebody, when you see a person suffer in the way that he made you suffer, right? Very powerful motivation. Totally forbidden. Totally forbidden. Not allowed to do that. I would like to hurt this person. Says the Chinuch, you know why you shouldn't do it? Because what have you got against him? If it happened to you, you must have had it coming. That's what he says. When a man hits a dog with a stick, the dog turns around, bites the stick, because it's a dog. This person hurt you, you lash out at him. It's coming from some other place. Which opinion does this appear to be, the first or the second?
First.
Appears to be the first, right? You only get what's coming to you. That's what he seems to be saying. I'll tell you why he cannot mean that. This is the famous source that you quoted, and many quote this as a source. When Shimi ben Gera cursed David, David said, it's not him, Hashem told him to curse, which is very difficult to understand. Here's where he contradicts it. This will take a little explanation, but it's worth hanging on. And after that, I'll come back to the beginning. In Mitzvah Tav Kuf Chaf Dalet, that's 524, yeah, he says this. You know, in Torah, you have a thing called Edim Zemimim. Edim Zemimim. Two witnesses contradict two other witnesses. Now, in Judaism, if two witnesses, let's say this person's on trial for his life, two witnesses say he murdered, two others say he did not. Case closed. Two against two, case dissolved. But there's one unusual circumstance you'd not have in non-Jewish law. That's called Hazama. Hazama means this. This person's on trial for his life, two witnesses say that he killed. Two other witnesses arrive and say, we don't know anything about the murder, but you guys could not have seen it. You two witnesses were with us at another place at the time of the murder. Maybe he murdered him, we don't know. They do not speak about the crime. They only say that you are invalid witnesses. That's called hazama. They are mazim. They accuse these of being false witnesses. Here you have two very unusual quirks from a non-Jewish perspective in Jewish law. Number one, we believe the second two, not the first two. We believe the second two. And we do to the first two what they try to do to the victim. So if they try to make him pay money, and it's obvious now they were framing him, and we see that they are false, we make them pay the money. If they wanted to have him killed, they get killed.
Who kills
them? The Beis Din. In Judaism, actually, the ones who actually carry out the execution are the witnesses. You want to testify? Let's see you. You take action. Okay, but so, these two say that he killed. These two come along and say, you're lying, you weren't there. We say, is that right, Elias? Fine, you get what you try to do to him. Now, there are two questions about this. Listen carefully. Question one, very weird. Why believe the second two? Maybe the first, maybe the second two are lying. Why do you believe that they are framing him? Maybe they're framing them! Think about that. That's a homework question. Okay? It's a logical answer to that. But there's something even stranger. And here's the law of Hazama. The law of Hazama is that these people get what they tried to do to him only if they were not successful. Not successful. The Torah says this. These two testify that this person committed murder. And they hear the evidence and they make a judgment that he's guilty. They take him out to be executed. Because in Judaism, there's no death row for 14 years. In Judaism, you get executed the same day. As he's about to be killed, just before the execution, these two rush in. Wait, stop! Terrible, miscarriage, blah, 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 stop. Stop. We stop the execution. What do you have to say? These two are lying. Okay, thank you very much. He's freed. These two die. But if these two testify that he murdered and they take him out to kill him and they kill him dead, and then these two rush in and say it's all a mistake, nothing doing, off you go, these two are free, no problem. Is that weird? They try to kill a man and fail, we kill them. They try to kill somebody and kill him, and we find out they did falsely, no problem, they're free. Is this weird? Is it weird? Listen to what the Chinuch says. There are famous explanations of this. The Maharal is a classic explanation. But the Chinuch says, I will give you a partial understanding. What he says, Ketzat Tam. I will give you a partial explanation for this law. And here it comes. But for this, you need to concentrate. If they try to kill this person and failed, you know why we killed him? The Torah says, they try to kill him, they get killed. But if they killed him, you know why we don't kill these two people? Because if you don't,
he was meant to die.
He was meant to die. What do you want from them? He was meant to die. He could never have died if it wasn't right. So what do you want from them? Which opinion is this? The first or the second?
First.
And here's where he turns it on his head. Listen carefully. Carefully. You'll make my day if you get this. He says, you know why if he dies he must have had it coming? Because this is a Beis Din, a Sanhedrin. And in every Sanhedrin we have a principle that God judges together with him. Elokim nitzav ba'adat hadayanim. Elokim nitzav ba'adaskel. God sits together with a Beis Din. Some commentary says the only reason that humans can administer justice because God says, you go through the motions, I'll be there to guarantee it. Meaning, when that guy's taken out to be killed, the reason we know that he had it coming, the reason we know this is correct, is because of the Sanhedrin. A Beis Din or Sanhedrin has Hashem's presence. And therefore, it's clear that he needed to be killed. Now, one more step. That's because it's a Sanhedrin. But what if it was just an individual acting in the street? They're all bets off. The Torah only guarantees you that Hashem assures the outcome because there's a special verse in the Torah saying that I'm there to assure it in a Beis Din. Which means that if you act unilaterally in the street, there's no guarantees. Meaning you could kill somebody that doesn't deserve to be killed. He makes the whole thing absolutely clear. The only reason we know justice was done and there was a decree is because Hashem sits with the Beis Din. Do you see this? This is what's called a diuk in Jewish law. Diuk means an inference. If we can rely on the fact that there was a decree and he had it coming in a Beis Din, we know that if it was not a Beis Din, it could be wrong. Because if you always get what was coming to you, he wouldn't need to quote the verse that says, this is right because Hashem sits with the Beis Din. All he'd have to say is, whatever happens is always right. It's always decreed. So you see, clearly it's not always decreed. Is this clear? Now we have the original problem. So why should you not take revenge against this person? And here's the answer. Because when this person harms you, if you're spiritually mature, you look at your own lack of merit. That's what happens. You say, I must have deserved this. Had I been a better person, I would have been protected. He might have put me in a situation of danger that I didn't deserve to be in. But I had been better, Hashem would have protected me. I must have deserved it in that situation. An immature person lashes out at the person who harmed them, instead of realizing that I shouldn't have been vulnerable. Again, you have to resolve these two sources. And the second one is very clear. Okay, let's come back to where we began. I'll stop for questions. He's sitting, you remember the original problem? Three judges, two are lying. So he thought you could have a precedent in the Sanhedrin. What's a Sanhedrin? All the judges are judging. When the last judge comes to speak, what must the last judge say? The truth. Falsehood results, no problem, Hashem is there. But if you're sitting with two liars, this ain't no Beis Din. Two jokers lying. Hashem does not sit with every liar. So the Pesachei Teshuvah writes clearly, if you're a member of a Beis Din, or a Sanhedrin, where they're honest people. Even if you disagree violently with them, try to convince them. If you fail, vote. You're outvoted. It's not a problem. It's what Hashem wants. But if you're sitting on a basting with two liars, there's no basting. Say, I don't know. Okay. Any questions? Yeah.
Two questions. First of all, one, the case you just said about Azamah, I don't understand. Why did we punish the Azam Zomah? Because they were still lying. That's question one.
Sorry, in the case where he died or didn't die? In the case where he does not die, that's where you get punished. The Torah says because they try to get a person killed, in such circumstances you kill them. That he doesn't explain. Again, they get killed for trying to kill somebody even though he never died, because the mitzvah is to kill them for what they tried to do.
I'm saying in the case where he does die, why don't we kill the false witnesses?
Because he's meant to die!
But they still chose to be...
They never caused anything that didn't happen. They wouldn't have happened anyway. And by the way, the evidence was false, right?
Yeah.
False.
Right.
So what do you? They're just liars. That's all. They didn't cause him to be killed. They didn't cause him to be killed, because he was decreed to die anyway. Okay. That's what he says.
If they're just liars, yes. In the case when he doesn't die,
yes.
And we punish them with death,
yes.
Why should it matter whether or not he dies?
Because the Torah says clearly that if they try to kill him, they get killed. But if he died, there's no reason to kill him. He's on that side. He's coming to explain. Because did they do a murderous act? No, they only spoke.
Okay.
They spoke.
So it's just the Torah authority.
Yes. He's explaining half. The Maral is another explanation of the whole thing.
Okay.
But the point I want to extract, not Hazoma, just this important point that he's explaining to you, that Hashem sits with a valid based in.
Okay.
Yeah.
The other question was, you were saying the point you were making that if you doubt this first, then you can be invulnerable. But if you do,
you might be, yeah.
Then, but so on the one hand, yes. It seems as if you could be just saying, really, it's just a question of semantics. You know, like.
Excuse me. What is semantic? Which case?
Because
isn't semantic. Scus is real. It protects you, and if you don't have it, you're vulnerable.
It seems like it's pretty much the same as saying you get what's coming to you.
It's exactly like saying you get not what's coming to you. Oh, you mean once he's put you in the situation of danger, you get what's coming to you? Totally, absolutely. Let's get this clear.
Right.
The thesis of the Or HaChaim is they could put Joseph in a situation of danger. What happens there is up to his source. Up to him. Totally fair judgment according to what he needs and deserves. But they didn't need to put him in the situation in the first place. And Hashem would not necessarily have put him in a situation of danger at that time. That's what you could do to somebody else. You have free will to put a person in a situation. What happens in the situation will invoke a decree. That's totally appropriate in the situation. But you caused the situation.
And does the fact that you have the free will to put them in that situation, does that to an extent take away from this concept of the Gamzu Yotova, that everything's for the best? If we have this free will to place people in certain situations, is that of Hashem's hands?
Yes, Hashem wants you to have the free will to be able to do this to other people. You have real free will in the world. In the end, it will be shown to work out for the good. By the way, the fact that everything is for the good, we are not perceiving in this world at all. That's why when Chas V'Shalom, something very bad happens, we make one bracha. When something good happens, we make a different bracha. The Gemara says in the next world, you make the same bracha for both. But we don't see that from here. Yes?
Why do we believe those witnesses and not those two?
That's for homework. Do you mind? This will take us off the track of tonight's subject. But it's a logical answer to that. The logical answer. So think about that. If you ask me after result, yeah.
If one person has free will to use some effect to another person that doesn't deserve something,
to put him in a situation that he doesn't deserve, that he wouldn't have been in otherwise.
So then, what are the victims?
What about the victim?
Yes.
The victim will get what's coming to him in that situation. But he might not have been in that situation if it not be for some malicious person putting him in danger. You know, there's a principle, once you're in danger, your books get opened. The Gemara says a person is ill, a woman in childbirth, a person putting himself in danger, the books get opened. Do you deserve to be saved in this situation? Should I do a miracle to save you? When you're vulnerable because you're going through a danger, it could be a natural danger like childbirth. A person's going through an operation. A person's in a dangerous situation. A person puts themselves in a dangerous situation. Someone else puts you in a dangerous situation. Then there's a calculation made in the spiritual world. 1 second, this person's in danger, needs to be saved. Does he deserve to be saved? Depends. Sometimes yes, sometimes not. That's why it's a good idea to keep yourself out of danger. If you mean this, in the situation, aren't you getting what you deserve anyway? Is that your question?
Yeah.
You're getting what you deserve in the situation. But who said you needed to be in the situation in the first place? To see it easily, I put it like this. The Gemara says you shouldn't walk into a place where there's a wall that's leaning that might fall. Don't walk under that wall. Why? Because if you stand under a wall that's about to fall, your books get opened in the spiritual world and they're examined. Do you deserve to be saved in this situation? So why put yourself in that situation? If you're out of it, the books aren't going to be opened. You can invoke a situation of danger by walking into it. What we're saying tonight is, somebody else can invoke a situation by walking you into it. What happens then is depending what's written in the books. Do you deserve? Don't you deserve? Maybe you're protected. Maybe your wife deserves to have you come home that night. Yeah.
So, from what I understood, the more righteous you are, the more unlikely you are to be put in the book of death or whatever.
Yeah, but
so
you can't always judge the righteousness of somebody
okay,
from your vision.
This is my question, though. So, yeah. The rabbis that were in that shul, and they were just in the middle of praying,
yes.
And they were actually the most righteous you can get, why
yes.
Did they deserve to be killed?
Maybe that was their time to die anyway. Again, don't misunderstand this.
All three of them at once in that way.
Of course. The Gemara, why is that strange? The Gemara says like this. Imagine a ship is sinking. Give you an example. Imagine a ship is sinking. And the people on it are all going to die at the same time. Listen carefully to this. There are two possibilities. Either as that ship is going down, these are all people who had the same moment of death, so they were invited on the same cruise. That's called Mazminam Lepundak Echad. After all, people dying all the time. So this is a way of getting them all together. All the people who would have died, right now as we sit here, people have died. You just didn't notice it because they're in different places. Or it's possible that some of them needed to die, and the others were in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's very scary. That's called Oile Rosh Oile Shechenum. The difference is, in the first case scenario, there's no way you can escape. In the second case, get out of there. You're there because somebody else is in danger. We can't read those situations from outside.
What you deserve, but
what you need.
I don't deserve that at all.
But we're all going to die. What are you talking about?
No.
People die at different ages in their lives.
Yeah,
we're
like
all
seven children each. I don't know.
But
I
think you're making an important mistake.
I don't know. Maybe I'm misunderstanding it.
I'm saying like this. When a righteous person in Har Nof dies of a disease and he's got seven children, doesn't it raise an issue, a problem? Why do those little kids deserve to be orphans? No? He gets hit by a car crossing the road. I mean, no. The incident that you're referring to doesn't raise the question. All these desperately disastrous and brutal events, whether they happen to be terrorists or... they all raise the question of how can bad things happen to righteous people. That's a much broader issue. It doesn't affect the discussion we're having tonight. Yeah.
In that particular case...
Yeah.
Isn't it based also on the merit of the murderer themselves?
The merit. It depends on his free will, but his merit.
Yeah, but you said it like...
As it happens, if you want to know, Ishmael,
the Ishmaelite
people, Ishmael, have certain merit in this generation, unfortunately for us. They're deeply believing, even though they're crazy. They have tremendous emunah, which is... They have a power of prayer, tefillah. It's a serious problem. Anyway, yeah.
Also, one more thing is,
yeah.
If something really bad happens based on another person's free will, you can't really turn around then and say everything's for the greater good. And
that's what he asked before. It will be shown to be for the greater good in the end. But we don't see
that.
But we don't see the greater good in any case when a young person dies, a child dies. We have no reason why a child should die.
But doesn't that bring it back to the question of, well, does anyone have any free will anyway, if it's all meant to be at the end of the day for the big greater good?
That's not tonight's subject. If you think tonight's subject's on, wait till we talk about that. How can Hashem know what's going to be in advance, and yet you have free will as well? That's a much bigger problem. Tonight we're only talking about one individual affecting another person. Yes, any other? Yes.
I just didn't get where Sadia Gaon stands, because he used this semantics, death or murder.
Yeah, but listen, but he uses that semantic phrasing only after saying, when there's a decree of death on a person, and then the person is murdered. All that happened is a death that might have happened by another means now happens through murder. When there's a decree on the person. We never know when there's a decree before it.
So does he support the second?
Yes, because he doesn't talk about the situation where there's no decree. No? Yeah.
Before you said an individual has to, in order for someone to suffer because of someone else's free will,
yeah.
It has to be an intentional individual against.
Yes.
Yes. But if someone gets in their car and they don't think they've put their foot down on the accelerator...
You mean they're irresponsible?
Right, but then someone else is infected and it's not using it. It's not...
So that's called irresponsibility and not murder. Again, you can kill somebody else of malicious murder. You can kill them through negligence. That's a lesser degree. That's called homicide. And that's accountable to a lesser degree. And you could kill somebody totally by accident where you couldn't have controlled it at all. That's another situation. They're all different degrees of responsibility. For example, if somebody kills somebody else murderously, there's one consequence. Let's say they kill them negligently. negligently, or driving carelessly. They never try to kill that person at all. That's a different degree of responsibility in secular law and in Judaism. And then there's a case where someone ran out in front of your car where there's no way you could have stopped. There's also responsibility. Why were you put in that situation? What had you done in the past that you were used now to be that agent of harm? There's a whole discussion about all those consequences. It has nothing to do with tonight's discussion. Yeah.
When someone of power loses their free will, does that mean they're not accountable for...
Someone of power loses their free will.
Like a king.
Yeah. No, don't make him... He's totally accountable for what he does. Totally accountable. But whether the population deserves to feel the consequences is up to what's decreed upon them.
But how is it bad that he's accountable if he's just being...
Because, again, you were quite happy with the first opinion, right? That when A kills B, even if he had no choice to kill him, even if it was decreed that he's still accountable for the murder, everybody agreed. Again, Mr. A's walking down the street. Let's get this clear. This is also for you. A's walking down the street. He has a decree of death on him. He's going to die at 11:36 a.m. anyway, because his life has come to an end. He was born with a certain amount of life in this reincarnation. That's what happened. At that moment, someone tries to kill him. So all he's guilty for is pulling the trigger. He was going to die anyway. Makes no difference in a human court. The person's fully accountable. Listen, according to all opinions we discussed this evening, you are totally accountable for your legal actions and your moral actions. The only discussion is, would it have happened anyway to the person whom you affected? That's the only discussion tonight. These people she's talking about, the terrorists in Hanoi, are completely accountable for what they did. Completely accountable.
Right, because they still have free will.
Of course. Whether the person that died was decreed to die then or not, we don't know. We're no way of knowing. But when you do a moral or immoral action in the world, according to all opinions, you're totally accountable. That's not up for discussion.
Doesn't say a president or criminals are not have free will, like Hashem's using them as a
puppet, as a tool.
Yeah.
I don't think that statement means that they can't think differently and they can't. That's I don't know if it's that extreme. I don't know if you have to go that far. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I need to think about that. Yes, any other question? Yeah.
So, if in Beit Din, yes, there is a sort of more gzirah and less free will,
yes,
so probably in synagogue the same, and maybe in temple.
What do you mean in synagogue? It's like this. When a Beit Din is constituted, 3 judges, or 23 judges, or 71, it had the halachic status of a Beit Din, in that circumstance only, there's a verse in the Torah that says that Hashem sits together with them and guarantees the output. It's a unique situation. Following the rules of din, where the witnesses examine correctly, all that happens according to the din, the money changes hands, that was correct. The guy dies, that was correct. Correct meaning, Hashem guarantees the outcome. Yes, any other question? Yeah.
You said earlier that the Egyptians were called many to be.
That's one answer, yeah.
Wondering why God allowed them to be terrified.
Because you have free will, and Hashem doesn't interfere with your free will. That's exactly the point. Exactly, excuse me. When someone's cruel to someone else, right? Do you ever see somebody being unkind to someone else?
Yeah.
Why did God allow that? Excuse me, why did God allow that? Because you have free will, right? Everybody agrees. You're totally accountable. Whether that person deserved that in the first place is tonight's discussion. Are you with me? And therefore, when the Egyptians acted more cruelly than the Jewish people needed, they have free will and they're accountable. There's no question about it. The only discussion is, did the recipient get what was going to happen?
Yeah, that's
anyway.
What I mean. So why did God allow that?
Excuse me, why did God allow the Jews to get more than was decreed? According to tonight's thesis, because you have free will and you could be more cruel to somebody than they would have deserved. You can ask the second question. How come in that circumstance God didn't protect them from that? They didn't have enough merit to be protected. Had they deserved to be protected, he would have stepped in. Most times in Jewish history, he does protect us. That's why we're still here. And sometimes he doesn't. Yes.
So when someone gets something that wasn't wrong for them, they didn't deserve. How is that like
rebalanced? What do you mean didn't deserve? You mean they were put in a situation of danger that wasn't going to happen. In that situation of danger, a calculation was made about whether they deserved to be saved or not.
So if someone shoots someone else with
yes,
a gun,
yes.
So and he dies. That's putting them in danger.
How do you know? Maybe the person would come to the end of his life anyway at that time.
So the person who was shot by a gun was going to die anyway because
no.
He didn't need to.
No, how do you know? Again, somebody shoots someone else, okay? They killed him. Either that person came to the end of his life anyway, and Hashem allowed that life to be ended by an act of murder, he would have died some other way. Or it was not decreed. But this person put that person in a situation of danger by pulling a gun on them. And in that situation, Hashem said, you don't deserve at that stage of your life to be saved against human free will. You don't have enough merit for that at this point.
So how is that rebalanced? If it wasn't decreed?
We didn't say it's balanced at all. According to tonight's discussion, that element is totally unfair. Don't ask me, is God going to make it up to him in the next world? Are they going to come back again? Oh, that's beyond my knowledge. Yeah, last question.
Yeah, so You mentioned how if someone makes the decision and pulls the trigger, he becomes, that's what he gets punished for.
Yes.
Whether or not the person was decreed to die or not.
Totally. The court doesn't know whether the person
decreed to die. So if somebody was decreed to die by drowning, for example, if somebody comes and saves his life, does he merit from saving
but then
his
he
life?
Wasn't decreed, punished? But then he wasn't decreed to drown.
But if he was decreed
but
to
he
drown.
But he wasn't if he got saved.
But you're saying someone can still change it, even if the decree was there or not there. It's
let's get this clear. If somebody was decreed to die by drowning at a certain time, there's nothing you can do to save him. Because his decree is more powerful than you. If there's no decree, God leaves it as an open question. The decree is this person's subject to human free will. There's such a decree too.
But you said they can do extra. Humans can do extra.
Only where God decrees that you're vulnerable to extra in these circumstances. Sometimes he doesn't.
So if the guy who walked past was vulnerable to save the guy's life.
Yes.
And he did.
Yes.
Even if the guy was decreed to die.
But he wasn't! If God decreed...
So whatever happens, that means he was always decreed
in
to
that in that circumstance. If you, again, we can conclude that God had not decided that he needed to die at that time. You see, he didn't. Right? The question is, if he did die by drowning, okay, and not anybody's negligence, no one pushed him in, then he reached the end of his life then. What else can you say? Yeah.
It has to do with past life.
Yes, past lives,
how
this life.
How can we have free will then?
You had free will in your past life. If you lived in a past life.
No, in the present life.
Yes.
Yeah,
your present life is a sum total
of a baby.
Yeah, that's right. A baby might suffer because it needed to go through that experience because of what it had done in previous incarnations. It could be.
So what free will does this baby have?
Nothing.
No.
Zero. No.
No free will.
Absolutely. Some people have no free will. He's acting out the...
Free will is only... A point
yes,
of a
that's
human,
right. You need to be over bar mitzvah, sometimes over 20. You need many conditions to conspire for you to have free will in a particular situation. Okay, thank you.